Last night I got a text from Sanghanath. Now Sanghanath is an Indian order member who I ordained about 9 years ago. Good friend of mine, again somebody I worked with in the Windhorse warehouse, and he is from the Dalit community, and he is now the trainer for men's appeals, Karuna appeals, where they raise money for social and Dharma projects in India. And Tom has just returned from that kind of appeal, and Sanghanath wanted to tell me this because they were 34% over target, I think. They'd done so well, and he finished off rejoicing in all the men in the appeal. And he finished off by saying, "Let us smash caste together." And so, I'm going to be talking a little bit about that. If you talk last on a day like this, sometimes your stomach sinks as speaker by speaker starts giving chunks of your talk away. And Savruti was doing that. Then I thought in the panel thing, I thought we were going to get into some of the areas, you know, and I didn't know whether to say, you know, quiet, I'm talking about that. I think maybe before I talk, I'll say that the first time I really heard about the movement in India and Dr. Ambedkar was when I was being interviewed to go on a Karuna appeal. Well, they weren't called Karuna appeals then, they were called Aid for India. And I was going to spend 8 weeks knocking on the doors of Bath, not Bath, but Bath and Bristol, asking for large sums of money from people. And I was kind of being interviewed and seeing whether I was kind of suitable for that. It was a brilliant thing to do, and it was the scariest thing I'd ever done, I think, until then. And I still can't quite understand that, because you knock on a door, you're not trying to sell them anything, you're trying to give them an invitation. If they're not interested, that is absolutely fine. So what is so scary? And I think it's just the... you have to be yourself. You have to be yourself on the door, you know. And as you hear them coming to the door, you know, it's quite visceral, actually. And you have to stay open and, in a way, vulnerable. But at the end of the 8 week appeal, I felt like a superman. I felt really, really kind of I'd done something that was worthwhile, and I had benefited, and I'd learnt something about my brothers and sisters in India. You know, so that was very, very kind of worthwhile. So if you get a chance to go on one of those appeals, or to sign up for Karuna, then do it. So although we've heard something about what it's yesterday, isn't it, that marks the day, I'm going to say something about that, because I've written it down and it won't do us any harm to hear it again. Today we're marking a pivotal moment in history, in the history of India, certainly, I think, in the history of Buddhism, modern Buddhism, and who knows, perhaps in the history of the world. Today we mark that event that happened 61 years ago, yesterday, in Nagpur in central India, when hundreds of thousands of India's poorest and most marginalised communities took together a momentous step. A step into the unknown that would change their lives forever. And we saw a bit of that in Yanishwari's kind of film. Someone who was on the appeal with Tom, an Indian Mitra, his grandfather was there on that particular day, and he had walked 8 days to get there. He didn't know quite what was happening, but Dr. Ambedkar had told him to come, and he wanted to be there. They'd come, all those many people wearing white, to answer the call of their tireless champion, Dr. Bhimrao Ambedkar. Many had travelled very, very far to get there, but I think Dr. Ambedkar had travelled further than anybody. He'd been contemplating that move for many, many a long year. So what were they there for? Most of you know, of course, by now, they were there to take refuge in the Buddha, in the Dharma, and in the Sangha. And if you're a Buddhist, whether you're a Western Buddhist or whether you're an Indian Buddhist, we do the same thing. We go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Dr. Ambedkar had tried to get freedom and justice for his community, the so-called untouchables, within Hinduism, again and again, and had been met a wall of resistance and a wall of indifference. And he'd sworn that although he'd been born a Hindu, he would not die one. There were those who took refuge in the Three Jewels on that day who said later that they felt they had been reborn. They felt they had been reborn. And there's a famous puja by Shantideva where you say those words in the puja. Today my birth has borne fruit. Today I'm reborn in the Buddha family. And they felt reborn. They felt like they had left the hell of caste. They'd been reborn in the Sangha of the Buddha that recognizes no caste, but only the capability of each and every person to awaken, to respond to the Dharma, to tread the path towards enlightenment. They were reborn as sons and daughters of the Buddha. And what was it like, you know, what was it like returning, you know, on that day? What would they be returning to? We're probably familiar with this term, untouchable. But I want us to spend a few moments, if we will, considering what that was like. Maybe if you were ever bullied at any time, you know, bullied at school or socially ostracized in any way, that will give you a little kind of a doorway into what it is like. What it was like to grow up and be considered so low, so degraded, so unclean, that even your touch was shunned. Even your shadow, or even the sound of your voice was polluting. Because there were untouchables, but there were unhearables too, who carried something to make a noise so that the caste Hindus would know they were approaching and could get out of the way. To grow up and see your parents humiliated and degraded in this way, and seeing that there was nothing, seemingly nothing, you could do about it. If you rebelled, there were repercussions, and sometimes those repercussions were terrible. To be told that you just had to accept your lot, right at the bottom of the caste system, in fact outside the caste system, your children condemned to this and their children. There's a phrase that in Dante's Inferno hangs above hell, and it says, "Abandon hope, all who enter herein." And that reminded me of the situation of the untouchables. To abandon hope may well have described the life of those oppressed people. Lots of things we take for granted were impossible for them. And I'm really glad Ratnasagar spoke kind of earlier and actually described from the inside kind of out what his life was like kind of growing up. They were expected to do the dirtiest jobs, like clearing away human excrement, for no payment. If you do the dirtiest jobs, you are seen as being fit only to do the dirtiest jobs. I remember reading a book, a really fascinating book, called Bloody Foreigners and quite a strong title, and it was about immigration into the UK in the last 1500 years. So people have been complaining about foreigners for 1500 years and more, probably. And when the immigrants come in, very often they have been waves of refugees. They have to go into the poorest housing. They're crammed in there. They look dirty. They look, they look troublesome. They look, all because of the situation that they're in. And of course, over time, they do better. They move out. Another wave of kind of refugees comes in. And there was a chapter on the Irish, there was a chapter on the Jews, the Huguenots, there was a chapter on African Asians being kicked out by Idi Amin and others, and there was a chapter on the Irish, and one Anglican bishop said, the best thing you can do for the poor Irish is to shoot them. Anyway, the Anglican Church has certainly softened since then. Untouchability has been made illegal. But listen to this. This is a Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International report for 2015, which raises serious concerns over caste discrimination. And it says the report finds that caste discrimination persists with adverse effects to human rights on multiple levels. Serious obstacles to access justice, discrimination in education and access to services, and caste-based violence, including the rape of Dalit women, are among key themes addressed in the report. And the failure of state authorities to protect the rights of Dalits. State authorities often fail to prevent and at times committed crimes themselves against Indian citizens, including children, women and Dalits. Although the law protects Dalits, this is Amnesty's report now, they face violence and significant discrimination in access to services such as healthcare, education, temple attendance and marriage. Many Dalits were malnourished, most bonded labourers, which is almost a form of kind of slavery actually, were Dalits. Dalits who asserted their rights often were attacked, especially in rural areas. Crimes committed by upper caste Hindus against Dalits often went unpunished, either because the authorities failed to prosecute perpetrators or because victims did not report crimes due to fear of retaliation. And of course, if you're reporting crimes within your village, you have to live with the perpetrators. So if anybody is in any doubt that crimes are still being committed against former untouchables or Dalits, that report, it makes pretty grim reading actually. That was in 2015. What happens to one's dignity and as a human being, one's sense of self-respect? Surely any society which demeans and approves of such practices is hardly human. Any religious tradition that sanctions such division hardly deserves the name. Sangharakshita, in his Ten Pillars of Buddhism, which discusses the principle of non-violence, the principle of love, says that to demean another person, to debase another person, is to demean yourself. You don't demean them, you demean yourself. If we ever treat another human being as less than human, if ever we try and reduce their humanity, it is our humanity that is reduced, not theirs. The former untouchables, the Dalits, were and are human beings worthy of the same kind of respect and opportunities for betterment as everyone else. In these very challenging conditions, growing up in these very challenging conditions, Bhimrao Ambedkar grew up, experienced firsthand some of the humiliation It's said that when he returned to India, probably the most qualified member of his caste ever, he got a job working for the local administration, I think, and caste Hindus would not pass him papers. They would stand at the doorway and throw files at him for fear of pollution. So in these very challenging conditions, Bhimrao Ambedkar grew up. Fortunately, he was encouraged in his education by a scholarship from the local Raja. He travelled abroad to extend his education, but he never forgot the humiliations and degraded treatment he had received, and he never forgot his community. He became one of the most educated and accomplished men of his generation. One of his greatest achievements being the writing of Independent India's constitution. But I think his greatest achievement was towards the end of his life. That day in October 1956, when he, and I think only he could have done this, relit the flame of the Buddha Dharma in India. He had a vision of the Dharma which saw it as the foundation and driving force of a social and political revolution. It was not just about changing one's life, one's own life, one's own personal life, but transforming society. I've been struck by a phrase that I've seen on the news quite a lot recently, and it's come out of the troubles in the States between the black community and the police. And people have been holding these signs up saying "Black Lives Matter," and I've been really kind of struck by that. It's a phrase that Buddhism would be very, very much behind, although we would extend it to all lives matter. Society is changing in India. Society is changing in the world. If you look at the news, very often you think that the world is getting worse. Actually, it's getting worse and worse. It's a very, very complex picture, isn't it? What's happening in the world? Some places things are improving. Some places things are getting worse. But society is slow to change, and usually change only comes when someone, some exceptional person, or a small group of exceptional people, individuals take a stand. And it's a courageous and it's a risky thing to do. A few months ago, I went up to Hull. Hull is, as you all will know, the UK city of culture. And yes, and I went up to Hull because I'd mistaken the title, and I thought the title was that they were the European city of culture. And I'd just been to Rome, and I was interested to see how Hull compared. But then I found out it was the UK city. And one of the things I didn't know about Hull, and Hull is a lot nicer than I thought it was going to be, one of the things I didn't know was that Wilberforce was the MP for Hull and lived in Hull, and you can go and visit his house. And he was one of the great movers, one of these exceptional individuals that tried to make the slave trade illegal, trying to get us giving up slaving. And it was really moving being in his house and seeing the exhibits in his house. I remember, some of you will remember this too, I'm sure Chandinad does, because he comes from a kind of lefty background like me, but I remember as a youngster watching a TV program, and it was about a demonstration in America, part of the civil rights movement in America, and I don't know whether it was 1 million or 2 million people had taken part in this demonstration, and they were now assembled by the Lincoln Memorial. And Martin Luther King was going to kind of talk to them. And he talks to that vast crowd. And then at a particular point in the talk, I think it was Mahalia Jackson, who's a singer, fantastic singer, but anyway, she says to him, tell them about the dream doctor. And then he tells in his talk, he talks about the dream that he has had. And I don't know about you, if you listen to that, I get shivers every time I listen to that talk by Martin Luther King. There were images as well in the civil rights movement of dogs being unleashed on black demonstrators, the image of water cannon, the beatings that took place. The dream of Martin Luther King, he told us it was a dream of equality, a dream of unity, a dream of mutual dignity and respect and freedom. He dreamt not just for the freedom of his own community, but for the whole spectrum of humanity to be united. Absolutely kind of fantastic stuff. And he says in the talk, doesn't it, that he talks about climbing the mountain. And he says, I may not get there with you. And quite kind of prescient in a way, because he was assassinated. I don't know how long after that, but sometime after that. But his words, his kind of communication, mark a kind of high point for me. What he did there was to give his people, all people, a dream. And Martin Luther King is a hero of mine, and Nelson Mandela is a hero of mine, and Dr. Ambedkar is a hero of mine. It's interesting to hear Subhuti talk about those two figures too, apart from Dr. Ambedkar. And Ratnasagar, I was talking about in India. India is ruled by quite an extreme Hindu party at the moment, and apparently Mr. Modi, the Prime Minister, has been saying wonderful things about Dr. Ambedkar. And I kind of, first of all, I thought, well, isn't that great? And then I thought, hang on a minute, what is happening? You know, one way to depotentialize something is to kind of embrace it, is to kind of to make it yours. Quite often in Hinduism in India, they say, well, the Buddha is an avatar of a Hindu god, and Buddhism, that's the end of Buddhism. You can't get a word in kind of edgeways there. Dr. Ambedkar too had a dream. A dream he seemed to be living out his whole life. He was born an untouchable, a Dalit, but he managed to somehow emerge from his background, and he became the guardian, the champion of the oppressed. He passed on his dream, and in India the dream is still alive. Rumi, the Sufi poet, says that men who dream in the day, and no doubt women too, actually, but men that dream in the day are dangerous men, because their dreams may change the world. Sometimes we daydream, don't we? We daydream, and it's escapism. But some people dream in the day, and they're dangerous. And very often society knows they're dangerous and wants to contain them. But Dr. Ambedkar couldn't be contained. He set himself against millennia of ignorance and prejudice, and he set himself against strong kind of political forces. And writing this talk and thinking about Dr. Ambedkar, thinking about Martin Luther King, how do people like Dr. Ambedkar manage to dream such dreams? How do they summon the courage, the energy, the vision to do what seems at times impossible? To do what they may never live to see. They may never live to see any change from that. They may die and the thing seemingly unchanged. How can an individual be a catalyst for such change? I want to go back for a moment back to America, to an event before that great talk of the dream by Martin Luther King, back to 1955, the year I was born, to December the 1st, to a bus in Montgomery, Alabama. And you may know, when I say a bus in Montgomery, Alabama, you may know what I'm going to talk about. I want to talk about Rosa Parks. And at that time, like many southern states of America, there were segregation laws. So cinemas were segregated, post offices were segregated, much like it was in South Africa under the apartheid laws. Buses were segregated. So you had the white seats at the front, and you had the seats for the coloured people, so-called, at the back. And on some of the buses in Montgomery, Alabama, there was a movable sign. So if more white people got on, the sign was moved back, and if any people of colour were sitting in those seats, they had to get up and move further down. And if more white people got on, they had to get off. Even if they paid, they had to kind of get off so that white people could sit down. And that was normal. I mean, it's really important to kind of remember that. That was normal. Quite ordinary people, good people, just accepted that. So Rosa Parks got on the bus, she paid her money, and she sat on one of those seats towards the back, behind the, in a way, the colour bar. The driver got up and as more white people got on, got up and told the people, the four people of colour sitting in those seats, that they would have to move. And three of them got up, but one of them didn't get up. Rosa Parks, a 42-year-old woman, refused to vacate her seat, and she made history. And it's interesting, she didn't think she was going to make history. That's not why she did it. She says later on, "People always say that I didn't give up my seat because I was tired. But that isn't true. I was not tired physically, and no more tired than I usually was at the end of a working day. I was not old. I was 42. No, the only tired I was tired of giving in." When she refused to give up her seat, a police officer arrested her, and she later said, "I only knew that, as I was being arrested, that it was the very last time that I would ever ride in humiliation of that kind." And many years later, an old woman by this time, she recalled, "I did not want to be mistreated. I did not want to be deprived of a seat that I had paid for. It was just time. There was an opportunity for me to take a stand, to express the way I felt about being treated in that manner. I had not planned to get arrested. I had plenty to do without having to end up in jail. But when I had to face that decision, I didn't hesitate to do so because I felt that we had endured that too long. The more we gave in, the more we complied with that kind of treatment, the more oppressive it became." She stood up for herself and her community. And it's interesting, she doesn't talk about me, but she talks about we. "I felt that we had endured that too long," she says. And something changed that night. There were other people trying to get segregation changed. Rosa Parks wasn't the only one who was doing this kind of thing. But somehow she became the kind of figurehead for this kind of resistance movement. And it was a bit like the first falling of stones, of pebbles, before a kind of an avalanche kind of gathers. The momentum of that change was sparked. And in Montgomery, Alabama, a young minister, newly arrived, became involved in that struggle, called Martin Luther King. A boycott followed of the buses. People refused to get on the bus. They walked, or they gave lifts to one another. And 2 years it went on for. And in the end, the buses were desegregated. In the end, a person of colour could sit anywhere they liked. And stories like Rosa Parks are to be heard in India, both in the past and today. And we had an international order convention in Bodh Gaya a few years ago, the first one. I went to that. And one of the activities we did one afternoon was we split into groups of Western Order members and Indian Order members with a translator, and we heard each other's stories. We heard the stories of those people, and I really, really moved the Western Order members. Well, I think everybody was kind of moved by it. So untouchability has been outlawed, but violence towards Dalits continues and has been increasing in recent years. It has not gone away. The law can help, but ignorance and envy run very deep. Now, I think Peter was asking what was the reaction of other castes to the conversion. One of the things that converting did was it gave people who had got no confidence confidence. They began to develop confidence in themselves. They began to improve their lot, and people were resentful of that. People wanted to keep them down. It's a very, very human tendency that I'm afraid in all of us. You don't mind being at the bottom, but you want somebody lower than you. So a recent survey showed that 94% of scheduled castes, another name for Dalits, still live in poverty. But change is coming. Dr. Ambedkar pressed for education, seeing education of his people as being the door to freedom. When you have an education, you can meet people at the same level. You can understand their arguments and you can argue back. You can bring about kind of a change. It gives you a voice. Before that, the Dalit community were dumb. It was as if they were dumb. They wanted to express something but were unable to do that. I think Dr. Ambedkar, the conversion to Buddhism, allowed them to speak. And he preached equality, liberty, fraternity. And I think somebody's already mentioned this, but he said, positively, my social philosophy may be enshrined in three words: liberty, equality, fraternity. But let no one, however, say that I borrowed my philosophy from the French Revolution. I have not. My philosophy has its roots in religion, not in political science. I have derived them from the teachings of my master, the Buddha. So Buddhism, let's look at Buddhism in the West. Buddhism in the West, sometimes seen by many as being something that is rather passive. Even part of the kind of growth and development movement. A passive acceptance of life. I remember travelling back on a train from Leeds, and there were these young guys, and they'd been partying, I think, at the weekend, and I could hear them talking, and they were talking about one of their friends, and they said, "It's his karma. It's his karma. He's just going to have to live with his karma." You know, and I was tempted to say, actually, you're misusing the word karma. It is vipaka. It's not his karma. Individualism is rampant in the West. It's a cult of one. And Buddhism can, if we're not careful, fit nicely into our individualistic kind of attitudes. We can even talk about my insight, my meditation, my spiritual life. I remember somebody years ago was working for me on a centre team. This is when I was a New Order member. And they said to me, they changed, but they said to me, "Listen, Atapri, I don't want to help with classes or with the centre anymore. I just want to concentrate on my going for refuge. Mm-hmm. I just need, the Sangha is actually getting in the way." You know. He had quite a lot to learn in that. But he did learn it. That's great. You can learn a technique. You can come to the center and learn a technique. Say mindfulness. And mindfulness, let me say straight away, is a very, very important tool for change. Or you can learn meditation, and then you can add it to your life as it is. Your life is indistinguishable from the life of anyone else. You are still a consumer. You live a conventional life, not necessarily causing much harm, but actually not doing very much good either. Where are other people in all that? Where is the social dimension? Has your growth and development become just a further enhancement of your ego? That is a trap. If you're not careful, you know, kind of Buddhism, your Buddhism can be a trap. Bhante says that before his contact with Dr. Ambedkar, he had not seen the relevance to Buddhism of political issues. He says it was his contact with Dr. Ambedkar and the movement of conversion he initiated that opened his eyes to the social dimension of the Dharma. Most Dalits lived in extreme poverty and ignorance, largely deprived of economic opportunity by their caste status. However, it was not merely to improve their kind of economic situation that a great social change was needed. Bhante writes, "I saw as a result of my connection with them the need to transform the whole of one's social life. It was not enough just to transform one's individual life. In fact, it was hardly possible, certainly for the majority of people, to transform their individual life without a corresponding transformation of the collective life of society itself." As a result of his contact, Bhante not only saw the need for social change, he saw its possibility. If he'd not witnessed for himself what they had achieved, he says he would have been skeptical that religious ideas could transform the lives of large numbers of people in this century. But Bhante's close involvement with them gave him first-hand experience that it was possible. He writes again, "I regard what is happening in India as a very hopeful sign indeed, and not just a sign of the revival of Buddhism in a narrow sense. It presents an example of a tremendous positive upheaval brought about in society by almost purely spiritual means. There has been a radical change in the ex-untouchables' whole way of life and position in society from top to bottom." And Bhante, influenced by this, having his eyes opened by this, it's influenced our movement. So when you when he was founding a spiritual community, he wanted to have a spiritual community that was committed to the ideals of Buddhism, the principles of Buddhism, and committed to one another. He didn't want a society, he didn't want a committee, he wanted a spiritual community, and a spiritual community that would reach out to the world. And I think if you are, you know, if you are kind of developing your self-awareness, you have a duty, part of that, a kind of intrinsic part of becoming more self-aware is to notice other people, to reach out to other people. We're not trying to develop a kind of more subtle self-centeredness in our practice of Buddhism. We're trying to get rid of the self altogether. I think when we look at Sri Ratna, we can see the example of Dr. Ambedkar and the new Buddhists. Let's call them that now. Not Dalits, not ex-untouchables, but new Buddhists. Like us, they are new Buddhists. How that's influenced our movement and shown us that living a Dharma life is not just about changing one's own individual life, but that in contributing to the growth of our Sangha, we are helping ourselves as well as others. And I mentioned the Karen Art appeal earlier, didn't I? And there you are, you know, the beginning of the appeal, you think, well, this is going to help other people. You have no idea how much it is going to help you. You have no idea how much it is going to kind of bring you closer kind of to others, both in the appeal and in India. We're used to plant metaphors, aren't we, in Buddhism? The Buddha sits on a lotus, he holds up a lotus, and that lotus is being offered to humanity. Not to a particular part of humanity, but to the whole of humanity. And a plant needs both food and water. But it also needs a positive, healthy environment for which in which it can flourish. Now, I mentioned the title of the talk is called "The Curse of Narcissus," and if you're discerning, you might think he hasn't mentioned Narcissus yet. I wonder where that comes in. It's a bit of a ruse, really, because the title that I had to begin with, I thought, oh, that doesn't sound very interesting. That doesn't sound, you know. But the curse of Narcissus, and the whole title of the talk was going to be, "Get Over Yourself, Will You?" Because I thought people from Manchester would like that, would get that. Let me remind you of the myth of Narcissus. Narcissus was the beautiful youth, wasn't he? Really disdainful and really kind of cool, you know, towards others. And others really, you know, really swooned when Narcissus was near. And he gave him the cold shoulder. I know Narcissus must have been felt like. And he's out hunting one day. Thirsty, he steps off his horse. He was on a horse. And he goes towards his pool of water to drink. And just before he dips his hand into the water, he sees this most beautiful image. His most beautiful youth staring back at him. And he stares at the beautiful youth with longing. And actually this beautiful youth seems to, you know, reciprocate. He is staring with longing too, you know. And every time he goes to reach the beautiful youth beyond the water, the image disappears and then slowly settles back. And Narcissus is just, he can't move, he can't think of anything but the beautiful image looking back at him. Now, why have I mentioned this myth? In the end, Narcissus pines away and dies. In some of the myths, he drowns. In some of the myths, he just fades away. And his sisters, who are the Naiads, who must be some kind of nymph, I imagine. They don't find his body, they find the Narcissi growing by the pool of water. And that's a posh name, isn't it, for daffodils. And I rather like that kind of, like that end of Narcissus, that it gives me hope that something is converted into something more beautiful, that can give kind of pleasure. I mentioned the myth of Narcissus because we are said to live in a narcissistic age, where society really encourages us to become more and more self-absorbed, and it affects everything. It affects everything. And I mentioned a moment ago about the danger of Buddhism becoming like that, where instead of extending your heart out to other people, through empathy, you actually build the walls of yourself stronger and stronger. But there is hope. There is hope. The Buddha said that self-love was the key out of the prison. It's the prison and it's the key out of the prison. And I'm going to finish the talk by just talking a little bit about that. If your self-absorption in a way deepens, your prison deepens. But self-love can be the key out of the prison, because by genuinely loving ourselves, by feeling for ourselves, if we open our eyes, if we take our eyes above the pool and see the people around us, we can see too that they are important for themselves. They're just like us. I'm important to myself. Sangadhara is important to himself. I want to be happy. He wants to be happy. I do things that cause me pain. He does the same, I think. I know, actually. He does. And empathy. It's like the loving oneself, feeling for oneself, knowing oneself is also the key beyond the self. Towards empathy, towards maitri, towards that kind of great compassion. If you hate yourself, that is a form of self-absorption too. People who hate themselves are so caught up with themselves. I hate me, I hate me. You know, so interested in oneself. It said that self-love also is the first stage, you know, the metta bhavana, where you come to yourself, you wish yourself well, and you don't stop there. So often in society we stop there. We bring together a good friend, don't we, a neutral person, a difficult person, and we try and make our love, our fellow feeling, you know, our feeling for others, strong and supple, and that can contain kind of more and more. Just tying this back in with the day, one of the things that really moved me about Dr. Ambedkar, the new Buddhist, is just their concern for their community, their concern for each other. Not standing on each other to get free, but lifting one another up as they get free. And I leave you with an image, and it's an image I think that I think reflects what's happening in India kind of very well. The self-help, and in that way being helped, and it can be a metaphor that will help us too. So when I worked at Windhorse, we had these weekends away where we had kind of team building. And our boss, Arthur City, he was a rock climber. So he took us rock climbing. And we went out near Moksha-Priya's place in, what is that place called? Well, in Wales.
Snowdonia,
yeah. There's a particular part there that is very, very popular with climbers. And we were roped up, and very, very quickly we saw that if we didn't look out for other people, we too would get hurt. You know, our safety depended on keeping other people safe. Their safety depended on us. It was a kind of reciprocal thing. And Artie climbed, actually with no ropes. There's a metaphor there too. The leader has to go alone. He went up and then he put the ropes down, and you know, and I was tied up, and I climbed up. Well, sort of climbed up, and then I was helping the person next to me, and he was helping the person below him. It was really kind of a great image for both. Progressing yourself, and how your progression is tied, literally, in the case of rock climbing, literally tied to other people, and how their needs are so tied up with your own needs. And I remember finally getting to the top, I couldn't stop laughing when I got to the top. I was so relieved, and each person that came up couldn't stop laughing. It was like the adrenaline or something was kind of released, and also the feeling of euphoria that we had done it, and we'd done it together. And for me, that is the image of the Sangha. You're doing it, you need to pay attention yourself, You can't be kind of hauled up the mountain, you know, like that. You need to pay attention yourself. You need to be mindful yourself. And you need to make the effort yourself. But you're doing that with others. And that's what they're doing in India. And that's what we need to do here.